listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We're very fortunate this morning. We've got Andrew Gibbs. He's a community advocate and a dioxin researcher. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Rodney.
It's a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Likewise.
I only wish it wasn't a tragic story.
Yeah, it's one of the sad things about these stories. It's something we don't really like to talk about. But, you know, many of the issues around this, both at Paratutu and nationwide, impact on many families. And, you know, they're significant issues.
Well, I think we like to hide from them. I know I did for a long time. Tell me, Andrew, how did you get into researching dioxin?
Well, briefly, I was born in Levin in 1961, and my younger sister was born in 1966, and she was born with hydrocephalus and spina bifida. And we rather foolishly, with hindsight, used to go and watch the plane spray next door. And I still vividly remember the smell. We were beside the market gardens on the north end of Levin. And so my sister Sandra was taken away from mum and dad. Many of the children with spina bifida were. And mum eventually went up to Palmerston North Hospital and brought her home. And Sandra lived till 6 months old, but it was quite a difficult period for the family and for mum and dad, I think, Rodney. We never went to my sister's funeral. It was a fraught time, I think, for the whole family. You know, it was rather unusual.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was a thing in the 60s, though, for children not to go to funerals, wasn't it?
I think so. But I think the bigger issue here was that, you know, when mum went to the hospital, my sister Sandra was by an open window and she felt she'd been left to die. And, I mean, having talked to the matron here at Westtown Maternity, late Hyacinth Henderson, you know, they had to deal with some pretty heavy stuff. And Hyacinth was an amazing lady. But one of the big traumas for the parents was having their children taken away and never seeing them. Mm. Like many of the Paratutu parents and other parents never saw their child once they gave birth, if it was born with severe abnormalities. So,
she was conceived in Levin.
Yeah.
The pregnancy was in Levin. You were right beside, where did you say planes were spraying?
Yeah, Market Gardens. Yeah. We were on the north end of Levin.
And they actually had an aeroplane spraying a market garden.
Yeah, right up to the boundary. You know, we'd go down there, concrete deck. You know, mum and dad had built a new house. They had a small bakery business and catered as well. And we'd go out and watch, and I can remember that smell vividly.
And what would they be spraying?
Most likely insecticides. In the 1960s, we used a lot of organic chlorines. Well, right from 1948 on, post-World War II, we had quite heavy use of insecticides, which were pretty nasty.
And we had no idea, did we?
The scientists had a little bit of idea they bioaccumulated, but to cut a long story short, we moved up to New Plymouth.
Yes.
And Dad...
Now, just to be clear, just so I got the sequence right, your sister Sandra, born in 1966, born with spina bifida, and another complication, you said?
Yeah, hydrocephaly. You may have seen the children in Vietnam with the swollen heads. Spinal fluid goes into the skull.
Oh, jeepers.
And you know, so it was pretty tough stuff, but mum and dad had the tenacity to bring Sandra home rather than leaving her at the hospital and deal with it, you know, as a family.
And then she got taken, did you say?
No, she was taken originally at birth.
Oh, I see. And they went up to the...
Yeah, and mum and dad went and got her back for the home.
Great.
You know, they thought it was wrong that she should be at hospital away from the family.
And she died at 6 months.
Yeah, 6 months old. And you know, the prognosis wasn't good for those types of abnormalities back in those days.
Did your mum and dad go on to have more children?
No, Sandra's the youngest.
Okay.
So, there were three of us before Sandra.
Okay.
Yeah. And so then we moved up to New Plymouth, 69-70. My sister was going to girls high up here.
Yep.
And Dad started driving for the crippled children. And he'd come home and sometimes I'd see him a little bit angry, you know, and I realised that a lot of the children he picked up around the Ivan Watkins Dow chemical plant. And I suppose I never really made a big note of that back then, but it did, you know, it clicked in my head. And so I went on to go and work at Telecom and so on and so forth. And everyone sort of knew there were issues around the Dow plant, you know, but they were a big employer. They're an American company, part American owned. As my late sister said, you know, one of the best jobs in town was to go and get a job at Dow as the secretary or the worker, very well paid. And so to cut a long story short, I then moved away up to Northland. And I'll really quickly run through what happened. And we moved into Mangawhai in a rural residential subdivision. And we were downhill from some avocado orchards, and they were spraying originally with an electrostatic sprayer, which charges the spray droplets and they attach to the leaves. It's a really good system. And they made a decision to bring in the helicopter. And I'd previously worked with Hughes 500s in the seismic industry, and I knew about rotor wash, and I'm going, this is not good. And so these were insecticides they were spraying. And they did one spray, and we had a bit of an inversion go on, which is where, you know, everything rolls down the hill. And we were breeding dogs at the time. One of the bull mastiff bitches, her hackles came up, stayed up for 3 months. And I'm going, it's a bit weird. We had a plant pathologist and GP up the road, and in discussion with them, we realised what these insecticides were. And they were all going to phosphate, which had arrived from nerve gases, basically. And one of the great ironies here, Rodney, is we were begging the neighbours to use BTK, as was used in Auckland for the gypsy moth.
Yeah.
And although there was opposition to that, we would much rather have had that than the organophosphate. And we even offered to run monitoring for them so they knew when to spray and stuff free.
The BTK is a bacillus, right? That is,
It's
like a biological agent.
But compared to the OPs, Rodney.
Yes.
It's a much better option, you know. I mean,
of course.
I'm telling you, if they'd sprayed Auckland with Lorspan or Lorspan, you would have seen some pretty bad outcomes then. And I doubt they would have done that, in fact. And, you know, there's some really good write-ups on Lorspan on the Intercept website.
So you're at this stage, you're wide awake, having experienced your sister, little sister Sandra. You're wide awake to the issues here now.
Oh, yeah, and, like, to me it was sort of like having a gun pointed at your head. I know that might sound extreme.
No, almost worse, because with a gun you can isolate the problem and deal to it, but when they're spraying, you can't almost get away from it if it's your neighbour.
Yeah, and I think the situation for us was a little different because the guy who owned the orchard on the top of the hill had rezoned the area of rural residential, right, to allow for lifestyle blocks around the orchard. So if it had been rural, I don't think we had a leg to stand on. And the orchard next to us was owned by three lawyers and a surgeon from Remuera, all King's College old boys. Yeah. And so they were fairly weighty sort of individuals. But anyway, long story short, we had a few standoffs, and this policeman came down one day. He was up from Helensville in the new year. And we'd had a bit of a confrontation, you know, because they're going to spray and the wind's blowing our way. And we said, no, you're not. And I noticed the helicopter pilot actually had the smell of alcohol on his breath. And once I raised that issue, he almost ran to the helicopter and gapped it, you know. He was out of there. And so we won that round.
Yeah.
But that night the police turned up, and they came back the next day. And the guy, I think his name is Ty Patrick, this nice guy, this cop. And he said, look, don't use a shotgun, get a video camera. I've seen this down in Helensville. And he said, get a video camera and videotape what's going on. So we did that. And Mike Valentine from the Home Show came up and they filmed the spraying from above. And that got shut down with a CIA complaint. And so we had all this video footage, and it was pretty damning. And we gave that to some guys at Small World Films, who made a documentary, Rubber Gloves and Green Fingers. And it was New Zealand On Air funded, and it got banned for a year as potentially defamatory. And it was primarily this footage they didn't want to go to air, because a lot of the public don't realise what's going on out there,
no,
you know, in the hinterland. And so, you know, we saw how the narrative was really, really being managed. And, like, I've seen a math paper written on that situation and said the neighbour's paranoia and perception of sprays is the cause of the problem. And so they're basically saying we're just paranoid.
Well, and they're saying it's your fault.
yeah, sort of. That's the one. But, you know, you're dealing, our lawyer at that time is Russell Fairbrother, don't you? He was in Parliament sometimes.
Yes, I know
Russell.
Yes.
Yeah, and he said, look, you're taking on the productive sector. To win a lawsuit, this has to be outrageous. But at any rate, as part of the strategy to get that doc out of here, we sued the three lawyers and the surgeon next door who owned the orchard.
Yep.
And we ended up having to settle and didn't win. But we stood our ground, you know, it was really a blocking action to get it on the air, and eventually the documentary aired. And so, you know, all our families sort of broke up, about three different people who were living up there who had stood their ground on this. And I moved back to New Plymouth. I was pretty messed up, you know. My child, social welfare, got my ex-partner to move back to New Plymouth with my child. So he was down in New Plymouth, I was in Mangapai looking after the property. And it was, you know, pretty hard being that far from your child. And Stephen, my eldest son. And so I moved back to New Plymouth.
How old was your son at that stage?
He would have been 1989. He would have been 4 or 5.
Okay.
And so he was going to have to go and stand on that road waiting for the school bus while Hughes 500 sprayed organophosphates, and I wasn't wearing that. You know, I mean, we wouldn't have done that. We'd have driven to school. But, you know, it was absurd. And so we actually approached Al, and they were quite helpful. You know, they brought out Don Huesler, who was governmental affairs from US or Australia, and he went to the aviation industry and showed them their footage. And, you know, they put a bit of peer pressure on the pilot. And amongst us all, the same pilot, Harry, drifted a couple of other people up there at Waiatura called Laurie Newman, an ex-MAF scientist, and Keyes Bond. And so we formed a bit of a loose alliance. And so Laurie was an ex-MAF scientist, and Keyes worked at Marsden Point. And so, you know, they introduced me to a bloke down here, Roy Drake, who had realised and thought Dow had poisoned them. And we all sort of knew it had happened, but everyone was a bit, you know, you can't take on this American company. And so Drakey was really militant about all this. You know, he had MS, he was in a wheelchair, you know, he was almost blind.
Oh, God.
And I thought I'd give him a bit of a hand, you know. So I started digging around a bit about Dow. We rang some contacts in the Ministry for the Environment, and they made us aware of these soil tests by Dow, you know, and in the residential area. And I'm looking at these soil tests and I'm going, geez. It's 100 nanograms, billionths of a gram per kg, about 5,000 nanograms or 5 micrograms a square metre, you know, to 50 centimetres. I went, well, how much would be there if you sprayed? And I went, like, 5 nanograms. And I went, so this is equivalent to being sprayed 1,000 times with 245T. This is in the residential area, Rodney. So,
goodness me.
So we sort of asked them to investigate. You know, they'd had a ministerial committee of inquiry back in 86. You know, you know of Michael Bassett. He actually ran the inquiry. I don't think the problems at the ministerial level back then, I think it's with the officials. We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
But when they had the inquiry, they tested for 245T, which breaks down really, really quickly. And over time, the emission controls had been uprated. And so to get these soil tests, Drakey had asked for them under the OIA from the health board here, and they've been really blocking them. And I got a bit irritated. This bloke's got MS, he's in a wheelchair, and they're treating him like, you know, not very well. So I went up and had a bit of rah-rah with them and got the soil tests. And the regional air pollution control officer, who's a chemist by trade, said, look, I believe these soil tests, you know, are from airborne emissions 64 to 69. And so I'm working this out. And at the time, we also became involved with some Vietnam veterans and World War II vets. And they gave us a paper from Vietnam. And I'm looking at that and realising the soil levels in Vietnam are the same as the levels in Paratutu. And I'm going, so this is like, you know, hut the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Good, you know, goodness, man.
The levels on air bases in Vietnam are higher, but the sprayed areas were the same as the Paratutu area. And so what they did in the 86 inquiry was tested for the herbicide, but they didn't find that in the residential area. They found the contaminant dioxin, right? And so I'm like, man, this is really bad. And my partner, who worked at the health board at the time, Iris, my second partner, with two children together. She was pregnant at that time, and I was pretty concerned, you know, by this point in the proceedings, realised she'd grown up beside the plant, you see. Dad was a wharfie, been a merchant marine in World War II, torpedoed three times, and jumped off the ship and moved in New Plymouth, you know. And I sort of realised more and more I dug that this was really, really bad. And, you know, I was hearing also stories about this metre-wide river of waste running out of the plant. And over time, we dug a bit more. So I wrote a bit of a paper and sent it to Annette King and the health board and the council and the regional council. And Bunkle picked it up and sent it on to King. And that paper was called Population Exposure Through Airborne Distribution of Dioxin, you know.
Yep.
And so eventually they agreed, yeah, we'll do a serum feasibility study on doing serum dioxin testing. Okay, and so we're getting somewhere. This is starting to be good. And then out of nowhere, blow me down, someone pops up and investigates this XIW executive and says, oh, we buried thousands of tonnes under residential New Plymouth and made AO. And then
Sorry, just slow down.
Yeah.
They buried thousands of tonnes
under residential New Plymouth, right?
And when?
In the 60s and 70s and manufactured Asian Orange. And what this was a classic red herring diversion. The guys at Dow, they'd been to the first meetings we had. They knew what we were talking about. And so I'll explain how it went down.
How cunning is that?
Oh, it's classic PR. You've got to realise these guys, the first major PR company in New Zealand was Consultus. So they did Lotto and GST and things like that. Their first job was also IWD.
Wow.
And so Farrington worked for TVNZ. Ian Fraser was also working for them. And we'll get to that later in the Paul Holmes debacle. And so what happened then was the whole thing switched on to this buried waste. And, you know, so they announced we're going to look at the risks in 2001 from the buried waste. And we'll look at residents after 1988. And the problem is, in the area they looked at, there were about 140 houses by 68. By 88, there were probably 350. Many of them were built after the heavy exposure. And, of course, all the children have moved away. This is total rot, you know. And so King knows this, you know. And so they do this diversion thing. At that time, you had three issues that were bubbling up them, the Hep C issue, the Lake Alice issue in Paratutu. Yeah. And so they were facing some pretty serious litigation challenges, right? And so as it's come out with the abuse and care, you know, this is all about managing liability. So at any rate, they flick it onto that and you know, there's multiple editorials and it's all good, no problem. There's no problem in the residents after 88. There's no risk in 2001. Now, what you need to understand, Rodney, is that the metre-wide river of waste was running down the track to the beach in 64 and 66. In 2001, there was nothing there. You know, this is an absolute debacle.
Can I just explain my understanding of what happened here? I mean, it's tricky for us following it because it's so...
So
what happened was there was this river of waste flowing down in the 60s and 70s. You draw attention to this. The Iverwatkin Dow there, they've got this newly minted PR company called Consultus.
No, Consultus were back early in the piece. That was back in the 80s, okay. Right? But you know, there are the articles on the red herring strategy. So, where you throw a red herring to the media and, you know, away you go.
So what they did was they created the scare story that there was this waste buried. That diverted media attention away from the actual problem,
which was
this river of waste. They have an investigation and say it's all good.
Yeah.
You've got to admire it. That's clever stuff, right?
Oh, you know, these guys are the masters of the PR game.
Of course. And so, oh, my goodness.
So what we need to understand here is, you know, when they made this stuff, the 245T and 240D acid were manufactured in water, and the precursors, which were where the dioxins were formed, the trichlorophenol, were reacted with acid and water heated, and they centrifuged the water off, and it was highly acidic. And within a couple of years of starting to manufacture that in the early 60s, it had killed a kilometre of sewer pipe, right? And the consultants at the time described it as a violent chemical attack. And so the solution was to run it down the access track to the beach into the tide, you see, until late 66. Then they moved it round the corner a bit out of the way. And they had sand soak pits, right? And then the excess water ran down into the tide. But as well as that, so that's the first bit of the process. You're manufacturing the 245T or 24D acid. They then centrifuged the water off, which is what killed the sewer. The next step of making the 24D, 245T esters, they react it with alcohol, okay? And they heat it. And in the early days, well, later on, throughout this, at the end of that process, they boil off the alcohol, okay? And what we found out from the workers was that in the early days, they didn't actually capture that alcohol. It just went straight out the vent, okay? And so what you had was these large vessels, you know, 5 or 10 ton of boiling 245T ester. And at the end, they'd just boil off this alcohol, boom, right? And one of the guys we talked to in the plant, they were immensely helpful, the people that worked at the time, talks about them recapturing that alcohol to recycle for economic reasons. That appears to be what led to a serious, serious change in the exposures, right? And so one of the twists here is that in the Vietnam War, at the peak of military defoliant production, there was a global shortage of butanol, which was the alcohol they used to make the 245T butyl ester. And so they switched to other alcohols. Now, to boil them off required temperatures of 170 degrees Celsius. The butanol was 117 degrees Celsius, okay? So when you get to those higher temperatures, you get way bigger discharges. You know, they only had condensers controlling it. And so what we found with the serum, there's a very particular period of exposure from the mid to late 60s, as Pilgrim identified in 86. And it's highly probable it was that boiling off at high temperatures of the alcohols. So you had the acid liquids running down the access track to the back beach through ponds, and you had the airborne emissions coming out of the reactors as well, you see. And so, you know, this was pretty messy stuff, but let's be real, Rodney. Back then, you know, we bulldozed rubbish over cliffs into the tide. You know, we were pumping sewage into the sea. Yeah, you know, as we know, our meatworks just were running rivers of blood and waste into rivers. Things were a bit different, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, different world.
But, of course, the interesting thing is I understand it, the sewage into the sea literally breaks it down. The blood and guts is blood and guts. Right, it's not pleasant in a stream, but nature will deal with it. But when you're dealing with these man-made toxic chemicals that don't break down and are highly toxic to us, that's a whole different thing. And yet we were treating it straight into the environment. I mean, I would happily, I'd much rather have blood and guts going down a stream past me and sewage out into the ocean near me than having any bloody toxic chemicals around me. You know what I mean?
Well, an example is a Waikato Regional Council report on hormones and environmental endocrine disrupting compounds, which are basically persistent hormones like dioxins, DDT and what have you. Yes. The Maui's and Hector's dolphin can bioaccumulate up to a millionfold the levels in water. You know, they move through silts and fats in the food chain. We'll get to that. But so what happened here is in the 70s, we had 10 Maui's dolphins deaths, right? Three were in nets, seven weren't. There were five more in the 80s, and they just disappeared. And so the most sensitive effect in mammals, both humans and dolphin, is reproductive failure, sperm counts, you know, so... you have to wonder about that, eh? You really have to wonder. And what got really interesting is eventually we found out in 1989, the health officials told TVNZ when they asked for stuff on the 1960s under the OAA, they had destroyed all those files. So we went looking for other departments that might hold sister letters, and what we found, there were two investigations into the outfall that got destroyed, and one into the airborne emissions, and they'd been destroyed, you know. So they actively destroyed the evidence. And furthermore, after we raised the issue in the early 2000s, they destroyed more important IWD files accidentally. But we got tipped off and we went and had a bit of a dig. And we OIA'd, can we have a look at the closed file register recording the destroyed documents? Oh, that got destroyed too. You know, so you're dealing with a fairly high level of silencing here.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Because government departments don't destroy a thing.
Not unless you've got something to hide.
Exactly right.
And you know,
and it has to be pretty bad, because it's an offence to destroy records.
Understanding what those documents meant, Rodney, like after my initial crude calculations, comparing it to how many times they had to spray, AES, as part of the ESR dioxin study, looked at how much dioxin was released, and they estimated 355 grams, right? And I'll put that in perspective. To release that much dioxin onto the soil, you would have to spray 74,700 tonnes of 1985-245T. It's incredible, you know? And I mean, so it's in a concentrated area. And so, you know, this was pretty nutty stuff. And so there's pretty big reason for these PR diversions. So at any rate, we finally get round to doing the serum study, you know, and they test the first lot of people, and they found very high levels in those there before 1968. And the initial report says targeting people from later periods would serve to dilute, because as awareness rose on the hazards of this product, Dow moved pretty quickly to reduce their emissions. They upgraded emission controls. They introduced vacuum atmosphere on the reactors, which reduced the boiling temperatures instead of ambient atmospheres. They upgraded emission controls, and in 77, 78, they upgraded them again. And you know, it's quite remarkable. After probably late 67, the only one of 33 people who had an elevated result was one incorrect group participant who was living in the area in 61, 63 as well. So they did a really good job of reducing it. But so what happened is Ministry of Health come in, they forced ESR to retarget the second part of the study at after 73. And can you still hear me all right
yes,
there, Robbie?
I've got you.
Yeah. And so they retargeted the study at those who would serve to the loot. That pulled down the average, but what they did then was really, really remarkable. They took all the adults that were living there by 66 and put them into a long-term group. And so they moved them out of that pre-73 period, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they isolated them, quarantined them, and they said, look, there's no clear exposure period. And this was all hidden by the anonymized data not being publicly available. And so this is not an accident. Many people in the media go, it's just an accident. You know, they do this linear modeling where they compare the predicted levels to the measured levels. And the modeled intercept for it told them clearly they hadn't found what they predicted after 73. The levels were very, very low. But they fabricated the evidence of ongoing exposure by moving those 60s residents into the long-term group. And so this shifted the exposures away from the elevated birth defects and stillbirths. And so we wrote to Hodgson, you know, and he said, oh, no, it didn't change. He just lied. We didn't change the study after we got the results. Well, in fact, they retargeted those who served to the loot. That didn't work. So then went to TV3 and they made an hour-long doco. And that sort of hit the fan a bit, and there was a bit of hullabaloo, and they promptly laid large BSA complaints on it and silenced that documentary. You know, they were, Mark Jennings described them as the largest complaints of his career.
Wow.
And
Mark Jennings was, like, he was many, many years head of TV News, right? TV One News.
Yeah, and so he described this as the heftiest complaint of his career, okay? And so about 2:14, I'm sitting online one day and I hit the ESR report and I hit one of the graphs and it says chart open, and I open it up and there's the Excel spreadsheets. They've left them open online. And the irony is they did this when they put the errata in denying the falsified data, right? And that's when I find the falsified data suddenly. One lady, Jimmy Stoppard's mum, Susanna, who's a wonderful lady, had originally arrived here from Britain, was in the East End in the Blitz, driving forklifts and building planes and what have you. And she lived there from 65 to 72, and they changed her into a 22-year resident. But we then realised it wasn't just Susanna. They'd taken out every adult and put them in that long-term group. And so we sent it to TV3. They didn't want to know about it, but, they had quite big broadcasting licence loans with the government by that point. We sent it to the Ministry of Health. They didn't want to know about it. And it took 9 years to get the media reported. RNZ reported, they asked the Ministry of Health, what about these 11 people being removed? And they wouldn't answer the question. And that's where the matter lies. So what this shows is they use the BSA complaints process to dishonestly silence TV3. So spent $33,000 on that to ESR and $15,000 the Ministry of Health. So then they said, after they came back with that, Dr. Daly said, we're going to look at the workers now. We won't worry about the residents. The levels are too low. And Helen Clark turned up in town the next day and opened an occupational health and safety centre. We got a tip off from the media and went down. That never went to air because, it was all a PR circus. Look, we're looking after the workers, But think about these chemicals, Rodney. The first sign of problems was maternal exposure. And stillbirths and malformations. Adult males are pretty resilient critters. We can take a bit of a punishing when it comes to chemicals. And so they sort of worked really, really hard to shift it away from the residents. And they said, they held a symposium in Wellington, and they said, no, the levels are too low. We don't need you to do the ESR, the recommended health study of the exposed community. Don't bother with that. We'll take 1.1 million and we'll do a study of the workers. And, so this was getting crazy. And then they do these two, a cancer and birth defect study. And the birth defect study looked at 38,000 in the 60s, a population that big. There are about 1,600 people living within a kilometre of the plant. The dilution is astronomical. And in the 80s, they looked at the whole of Taranaki, 100,000 people.
Crazy,
and the cancer study looked at 53,000 to 66,000. It's absurd. Having denied the study of those exposed, then these huge studies are still on their website, So this is just getting ridiculous by now. And then after the TV3 thing, eventually they come out and say, we'll do an early intervention health plan. We'll bring that out in 2008, 40 years after the exposures, to prevent the impacts. People were dying prematurely of cancer in 81. The birth defects clusters were 68 to 72. This is just, it was obscene. Alan and Clark were paid $448K to draw up that health plan, free GPs visit. And, so what we've got to realise here, Rodney, is with New Zealand, we use these chemicals. Once we cleaned up 245T, we cleared something at 19,000 square kilometres of agricultural land was brought into play between 68 and 81.
Sorry, say that again, Andrew. I'm sorry.
19,000 square kilometres while it was being subsidised. 7% plus of New Zealand's land mass was brought into agricultural use. They were really important for the economy.
Yes.
So, you sort of understand all that, but by 2000 when we raised it, people didn't want a fortune. They just wanted a bit of a help with the medical bills and a bit of a hand, And this community has higher exposure probably than the Vietnam veterans, Rodney, and it involves maternal exposures. But, back in the Reagan years, there's some memos we were given from Congress, and they cite liabilities from radiation in Agent Orange potentially in the hundreds of billions. And they say we have to organise our position because we'll be in the tenuous position of paying compensation to veterans and denying it to civilians with many cases with higher levels. There is some pretty crazy stuff going on out here, They were from the Office of Managerial Budgetment to Reagan's office, And so One of the other things a lot of people don't get, Rodney, is that because these products go through the food chain, okay, through fats in the food chain, and you spray them on the pasture, and the dioxin levels were very, very high up in the 50s particularly. Dioxin was discovered in 58, and Boehringer developed a method of reducing the dioxin level by lowering the reaction temperature of trichlorophenol. And so, you know, that sort of helped. And then, but in Vietnam, they made it quick. It's cheaper, and so it had high dioxin. But those same products went into domestic markets, you see. And there's a wonderful Congress paper from 78 in the States. And these geezers from the Air Force are saying, look, we probably use four times more dioxin in America than Vietnam in the 50s and 60s.
Goodness gracious.
And so when they finally tested archive fats in America, what they found was the civilians had as higher levels as the veterans. Not as the guys that sprayed it, but the infantry on the ground mirrored the American population. So Dow's big narrative is to focus on the veterans. It's not to say their exposures were not significant, but the control population is also exposed, you see.
It's so dark, Andrew. How do you live with it?
It's a struggle sometimes, but what I really hope one day is, you know, these companies knew. You know, they knew from really early in the piece. Boehringer knew from 58. Dow knew from 64, and Boehringer, extraordinarily dangerous. Is why are the government not going after these companies for some, you know, at least a cutback like borrowing and manufacture pharmaceuticals? Why are we not asking them for a bit of a discount on their pharmaceuticals we're getting?
Mm.
You know, there are people out there like Mr. Mulholland down there, Patient Voice, advocating and fighting for cancer drugs. And, you know, by controlling these narratives, like, you know, Nationwide, in the Nationwide study in 97, they looked at the dioxin levels in 97, but they probably peaked in 62. That's what the ESR study said. And so, you know, our real cancer burden has gone up incredibly high. I mean, it's, you know, tens of thousands of excess cancers nationwide. And so you have to ask, you know, BHC was crazy stuff, the benzene hexachloride. Two cousins in Czechoslovakia in 58 were unloading it. Both were dead within months of acute myeloid leukemia. A farmer in Sweden in 53, spraying it on the tractor, dusting a paddock, 60 acres, dead within months, you know, no bone marrow left. These products were banned in 61 when they detected in our beef going into the States. And so, you know, the government know what went on, but basically by managing the narrative, they managed to keep the public in the dark. And this really disempowers them with mind to gaining access to better pharmaceuticals. But what I'm saying, and healthcare, is should the companies did this not pay?
Well, we've got a long road even to expose and have the government come on board to what has actually happened, the truth.
Yeah, well, this is the problem, isn't it, Rodney? I mean, the media have been abysmal on this issue. You know, it's been a real struggle. We're talking about that reframing right at the start.
Mm.
And like after Let Us Spray, when they made those BSA complaints, they said, oh, it's been peer-reviewed. What they didn't tell anyone, they didn't peer-review the embedded data. So the regrouped data was never peer-reviewed, ever. And the media just went, oh, it's all good, clickety-boo, you know. And I mean, our media really lack the ability to do penetrative investigations, I think. And they simply don't have the resources at the time, you know. So there's something we need to shift away from. And I wonder whether state-funded media is a good thing, you know, because it's an invisible hand, whether it's conscious or unconscious. We always had to go to Investigate or TV3 because the state-funded media were really reserved about how far they'd go. You know, and then you have things, yeah.
And then even then, you go to TV3 and these companies can employ big PR campaigns and basically baffle the journalists with bullshit.
Yeah.
And also, there's a lot of money washing around and a lot of money at stake. And you're like an independent researcher with two pennies to rub together up against it.
Yeah, and like, you know, you've got to remember New Zealand government in today's dollar terms spent about $1 billion subsidising agrochemicals and land noxious weed eradication schemes. We also put about $8 billion in superphosphate, you know, contaminant over the cadmium. So, you know, it's really powerful interests here. But, you know, what I find intriguing is how the ministry were able to silence TV3 and the media are aware of that but won't report it. It's astonishing.
It is astonishing.
And it's evidence. It's evidence, you know. I mean, we've got the spreadsheets. So the response when we asked them about, RNZ asked them about that 11 people being moved, was they shut down access to the anonymised data. But the problem is that anyone that downloaded the Word copy of the report from 207 to 223 has that data in their Word copy of the report. And, you know, it's just, it's mind-boggling, you know, and you just stand there going, the obstinate difficulty in doing it, you know, and like, you know, you have guys like Professor Alan Smith who stood up at that symposium in Wellington when, look, the public just want to be told they're safe. You know, well, some of us actually want to know what went on.
We want to know the truth.
Yeah, and we want it dealt with. You know, and dealt with is why should the taxpayer pay? You know, we paid to use this stuff. If they knew it was dangerous when we paid them to use it. For example, the FDA, the Department of Agriculture in America, in February 69, they knew about the Bionetic stillbirths and malformations in animal studies. We brought in the subsidy in July 69, so they knew before we brought in the subsidy. They warned us in November 69 officially, and, you know, we just kept pumping this stuff out. You know, they stopped spraying in Vietnam. We paid Dow to make it. You know, we're really clever. You know, Messel from Harvard went and rocked into the office of Nixon's advisor, Lee De Bridges, who was a physicist from Caltech, and I think David Harvard, Packard, is Hewlett Packard co-founder, and they banned it on the spot. They brought in restrictions then and there. We kept paying to make it, you know, and we're saying we're cleverer than these people.
Mm. Really? Tell me, did we make Agent Orange?
I don't think we did.
Okay.
And I don't think we had the capacity, Rodney, but we miss our bigger point. The bigger point is the evidence from New Plymouth in New Zealand supports the position of the Vietnamese people that it does cause maternal birth defects, particularly maternal. And, you know, that's the bigger point here, is that there are very few maternal studies. Mm. And Hyacinth Henderson's was pretty amazing. You know, it detected what they found in Vietnam. And so with regard to the Agent Orange question, why would they sell it cheaply to the US military? They were exporting, what the confusion is around, we exported into America to infill the American market because the Americans, they requisitioned all domestic 245T for military use, okay?
Okay.
So we infilled the market at a higher cost. We also exported up to Manila. And, you know, I work at the port, Rodney, and I've spent decades working through this, and a lot of smoke and mirrors. There were shipments to Manila, which turned into Subic Bay. You know, it was MCPA, and their shipments went to Tacoma, Seattle. But a lot of that came out of the diversion and a media fascination with Vietnam. But what the media missed is the stuff we used here in the 50s and 60s was just as dirty. And all the data says that. You know, the first breast milk test, we didn't test our population for 40 years after we started using this stuff. The first sheep test for 40 years after we started using it. And so the first breast milk test found that women born in 59 had much higher levels than women born in 69. And, you know, all the data's same. If you stratify the 9 spray applicators by those that sprayed before and after the Boehringer method was introduced, you know, the reduction in 58, their levels are 3 times higher. You know, and it all points to that really early stuff being really, really dirty. As early as 74 to 78, 1974 to 78, we were seeing clustering of elevated rates of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, a USIOM cancer, in rural areas, and particularly in females. And you go, well, wouldn't it be the bloke spraying it? You know, wouldn't it be the guy handling it? Well, here's how it works. In the Committee on Inquiry in 87, they found 90% of chemical and contaminated clothes is removed during washing, okay? So back then you had the copper and the Ringer washing machine, okay? And old Paul Holmes, you know, he back in 2004, he went and did some tests. The Ministry of Health tried to stop him. And the highest level found in a female, higher than any of the females that worked in the Dow plant, was the wife of a worker who worked in a particularly dirty part of the plant, buried waste and incinerated it. And her level was higher than any of the females that worked in the plant. See, because a lot of this stuff, she talks about hanging the washing out and it killing the grass under the clothesline.
Goodness.
And so with the, yeah.
So Paul Holmes did a major investigation, found this out, and then what happened? Did he put it dead?
He was gone before the results got back.
Gone from the show.
Ian Fraser was his boss. He was gone.
Goodness.
He paid for the tests or whoever paid for them before the results came back from Germany. He was gone.
It's gobsmacking, is it not?
Well, it's a pretty serious caliber game, you know. You know, and as at that time, the head of TVNZ was Ian Fraser.
Oh, who'd worked for Consultus.
Bingo. Yes. And so, you know, Paul Holmes really, really intimidated them. So when they first started that birth defect study, Holmes was advertising for parents of children with abnormalities, you know, to come forward. And so they put out a memo and said, oh, we'll start this study. We'll focus on parotid. It'll be done by February 2005. It didn't emerge till November 2010. And instead of looking at Paratutu, it looked at 38,000 population, the whole New Plymouth. And the second part looked at 1980s, 100,000, the whole of Taranaki. You know, I mean, it's not even hard to get through this, Rodney. No. And you just look at the media and shake your head.
It doesn't have to be hard to confuse a journalist who wants to be confused.
Sorry.
And to get a headline and everyone says, oh, phew, it's all okay.
Yeah, yeah. Just tell me.
Paul Holmes was a great man.
Yeah, interesting, Rodney. You know, when the Vietnam levels were found in 2004, he was the only journo that realised you had to backdate that level from 2004 back to when it happened. And so how they spun the data, they said, oh, it went right on to 87. You know, and so if you use a half-life of, say, 7 or 8 years, that's about fourfold what they measured. If it's back in 68... You know, it's more like 20-fold, give or take a bit.
I had a, you know, bit to do with him when I was a politician, and then I got to know him. And just by the by, he was super, super intelligent.
Oh, there's no doubt.
Extremely well read. There's hardly a book he hadn't read. And he had this extraordinary empathy for people, for everyday people.
I think he also had some form of a very clever instinct.
Yes.
To know where to push to.
Yes.
Yeah, and an amazing bloke.
Amazing bloke. I think. And he was world class in this, and he worked, in my observation, with pygmies at TVNZ.
Yeah, he was hamstrung.
And in a small country, if he'd been in America, he would have been a superstar as well. As, you know, he's a superstar in a small country. He could have been a superstar in a big country.
Absolutely, Rodney. But as I say, of all those journalists on that day, you know, we're getting swarmed with journalists. Only one of them knew that you had to backdate it. It wasn't what they'd measured in 2004. Those tests were meant to be done in 87. You know, so delayed it 17 years. But he said, well, you know, so you've got to backdate this, don't you? I said, yeah, correct. You know, and just very, very, very sharp mind, as you say. And so a lot of people saw the goofy geezer on TV, you know, and it was very much not so.
Another thing I discovered about him, I'd take him sad cases and he would put them to the everyday people, make a great show, and he would ring them and check in on them for months afterwards, just to see that they were okay. Like, he actually cared about the people on his show.
I know when the Ministry of Health tried to obstruct him doing those dioxin tests on the workers and the wife of that worker.
Yes.
They weren't really sure whether he paid for them himself or TVNZ did.
Yes.
But I suspect he may have well paid for them himself. They're talking 10K.
I'm sure he would do that.
Yeah, that's the sort of geezer he was. And I mean, an amazing man. And like, sadly, you know, probably one of our last, you know, hard-hitting journalists.
Yes,
I mean,
yes, exactly. You'll never see the like of him again in this current crop. So have we brought up to speed, Andrew? Is there more to add? The show's yours.
Well, there's plenty more. I mean, you know, for me, Paratoota is the tip of the iceberg here, Rodney. You know, when we look at our look at that insecticide and dioxin use, you know, back in the 50s and 60s. And so, you know, Brian Arndt, I think, the guy talking to you about the left.
Yes, indeed.
He talked about the Otago study. And back in 2002, they did an article in the Lancet, you know, and they said, look, we're a bit perplexed. The breastfeeding children had double the rate of asthma and allergies. And, you know, the most sensitive impact in offspring of these types of chemicals are immune, fertility and reproductive and neurobehavioural. And, you know, then you look at the Fertility Associates did a sperm count study, and they did it by year of donation, and I simply changed that to the median year of birth. And what you find is about from the mid-50s to the early 60s, our sperm count's halved. You know, so I'm looking at the year of birth for those donors.
Yeah.
And so, you know, realising these compounds cross the placenta, and then if you breastfeed, you went double mum by about 1 year old. You know, I believe what I've seen in Paratoota is the most effective group of those that were children when they're exposed. And you know, Smith said in his study on New Zealand, we don't really know what this does, this blip of contaminant exposure. You know, it's not happening now. It was back then. But if we look around us, Rodney, I'm sure you have many, you know, colleagues and contemporaries have passed prematurely, unfortunately. And I think our generation has seen this going on around us. I mean, if you look at, I compared 1958 to 67, that decade.
Yep.
And so if you adjust it by population, there were 15,800 cancers in that period. 2008 to 17, you would expect 28,200, right?
Yeah.
There are actually like 93,000, 65,000 more than the population increase. And the Ministry of Health will tell you this is because of population, ageing population. You know, that ageing population also born this period. So, okay, let's say that back then they weren't as good at picking up the cancers. Let's look at 1968 to 77. So you had 25,999 cancers over that decade, incidence, right? If you adjust it by population to 2008 and 17, you expect 39,300. Actually, 93,681, an excess of 54,371. These are not little issues, Rodney. And, you know, I think we're entitled to some answers here. And, I mean, looking at NHL, which is one of the ones the USIOM link, 68 to 77, there were 1828 cases. It's quite a rare cancer. You'd expect 2,760 by 2008, 2008, 2017. They're actually 8,077. This is a linked cancer. It's linked to herbicides, except in Vietnam veterans. And, you know, you just look, and those numbers I'm talking about, for cancers, I'm just talking breast, prostate, and bowel. I'm not talking all cancers. You know the numbers where I'm saying excess is 54,000, you know, over a decade, so it's 5,400 a year. I'm talking three primary cancers, bowel, breast, and prostate. And I don't think it's just dioxin, and I don't think this is the only, you know, I'm not saying this is all because of dioxin. But if we look at our insecticide use and how it went through the food chain, some of the BHCs, in the early 50s tests, they did some tests for butter tainting. And, you know, they found when they put stock on pasture, the butter had 543 parts per million of BHC if they didn't withhold the stock. You know, incredibly high levels. You know, things like wild pig, the My mate, Laurie Newman, he made off the few documents from MAF. He's passed on now, Laurie. But one of the things they found was wild pigs in the South Island, up to 75 ppm of DDT.
Yeah.
And the MAF crew are going, oh, they must be semi-domestic. What the Muppets didn't realise is, of course, wild pigs eat dead lambs, don't they? And, you know, so some of that stuff in the 60s, when they had that problem with the American beef, they did some studies and they found that dipped sheep had 20 parts per million of dealdrin after dipping. The lambs of the dipped sheep had 6.2 parts per million 5 months later. And, you know, so we had significant exposure. You remember the red and the blue stripe meat export and local meat? Why was that?
I don't know.
Maybe they had to meet overseas residues.
Where do you see this going, Andrew?
I don't know. I'm pretty much at my wit's end, Rodney, to be honest. I'll probably put up a website. We wrote one paper with a criminologist from Victoria U. And, you know, a couple of the blokes here want to try and take legal action, but it's pretty hard yards getting very a lawyer
hard,
on this.
Very hard. And you're up against...
But, you know, I mean, the case is clear cut that the Crown have intentionally falsified data, and my position is simple. If you conceal wrongful death and injury, that's a criminal matter, isn't it?
I would have thought so.
Yeah.
Do you think Robert Kennedy Jr. will make it? Obviously, he's going to make a difference in America. That must filter through here too and change our view of these big chemical companies, don't you think?
Yeah, well, Russell Fairbrother, he's told me to read this book on a guy called James Schlickman, who's a similar character to Robert Kennedy.
Yeah.
And he was a lawyer that did a case in Woburn. You know, and he took the company on, and they'd poisoned the drinking water. And he basically self-funded all the studies. He ended up selling his Porsche, selling his office, living on friends' houses, bludgeoning coffee, you know, bankrupted himself. And, you know, the litigation path isn't ideal, but I think if we had a smart government, we could shame Boehringer into actually giving us some pretty mean discounts on some pharmaceuticals. I think they have a bill to pay here.
And but, of course, you know, some of these pharmaceuticals are as bad as being sprayed with 2,4,5-D.
I know, but when someone's got a terminal cancer, and there are some farms, I'm talking about the cancer level and other treatments. I totally agree. Look, I'm not arguing with you on that, Rodney, but some of the more modern hardware in the cancer arsenal is getting pretty interesting, isn't it?
Yes. You have done your little sister Sarah Proud, haven't you?
Sandra.
Oh, Sandra, sorry.
No, it's all right, Rodney. Yeah, well, ironically, my other sister who pushed me pretty hard throughout her life. Sorry, it's just my phone there. My other sister, Karen, she went through three rounds of breast cancer, and she passed away some years ago. And, you know, so, you know, I think this is part of my way of putting a bit of pressure back on them. But, I mean, there are many families that have gone through similar issues in this country, Rodney. And I think the big thing is we're all a bit afraid of cancer, aren't we?
Yes.
I mean, I know I am.
Yes. Well, you've seen it. Close.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, every time I get an ailment, I think I'm going to croak it, you know, because it's been so much. I've had this virus, and here it comes, here it comes.
I'm getting to an age, you are too, where you sort of think, oh, well, you know, I've got to here. It's less upsetting, if you know what I mean. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had a good innings.
I'd still like to make 90 plus, like my mum, but I'm not out looking for it. But it's not. It's when you're. It's a 6 month old baby. Fetal abnormality.
And you know, parents having children born with cancer.
I know.
Watching their children pass at early age, that's really, really hard. And you know, then you've got the other side of this. I mean, Keyes Bond, my mate with Laurie, who, you know, we set on this path with, he went through America and he went to Germany. He got all these documents on Boehringer. So when he banned that BHC, they discovered they could reprocess it into the precursor precursor for 245T. And so he was bringing back those documents. We had quite special 245T that was made from a banned chemical, you see. And Keyes got back into the country. I don't know what went down, but him and the documents went up in flames 2 days later. That was on October 202.
He went up in flames?
Yeah, he perished in a house fire, yeah, with the documents. He was on his way down here. And, you know, one of the ladies who'd gone to see Carol von Strum, she led the fight in Oregon to stop the spraying of 245T and 24D. In 75, 76, they took action against the Forest Service to stop heli spraying. And I think in 78, her house went up with her four children. And you know, there's been some pretty serious stuff going on.
The fire in New Zealand, was that suspicious, yeah, that fire?
They say, you know, basically they're saying no, but I mean, I know what he was carrying now, Rodney, and like the documentation he was carrying, we have a unique profile in a 245T here, or did, because it was made from a banned chemical. He'd been to see these professors in Hamburg, right? And what he was carrying, and they've just published a paper, the EU, on it last, I think last year or the year before. And so when they banned this BHC-666, do you remember Lindane, a chemical called Lindane? Yeah, so Lindane was a purified BHC-666, and they had mountains of waste that they extracted. And so what they did, Boehringer discovered they could cook up that waste and make the precursor for 245T. But it produced a much wider range of dioxins, you see. And so Keyes was carrying that. It's pretty grunty stuff, you know. I'm not sure he even knew what he was carrying. You know, he had some idea. He said, we're not talking about one dioxin. Traditionally, there's been one dioxin attached to 245T. We have a second dioxin that dominates our profile throughout the environment here. And I must make clear, it's gone out of the food chain now. You know, top of the food chain, you'll find it. These events happened a long time ago, but I think when you look at like what Skinner and his colleagues found at Washington State U in 2012, you know, they found the epigenetics say that, you know, three or four generations can be impacted by these types of chemicals.
Indeed.
And rat studies have proven that. So, you know, the consequences of this, I have been told that in a cabinet meeting in the late 90s, with regard to Vietnam vets, the term genetic bubble. If you can imagine, you know, when you blow, the child blows bubbles and the whole lot of little bubbles come up.
Yeah.
And that's the liability problem here, you know. It's ongoing.
And Andrew, I often end these interviews by saying, what a world we live in. And it is, you think, what a world. What a world this is to have this. And you've lived with it all these years.
Yeah, but I mean, I can look outside and I still enjoy my life and, you know, I can compartmentalise that. You know, for me, the big thing is the time I've lost my children.
Yes.
And, you know, that's been harsh. And the isolation, you know, it's like, I think Denny Holmes said it once, you know, he said one blade of grass sticks up in New Zealand, 10,000 lawnmowers come out to chop it down.
Yes.
And you know, you see people like him, Bruce McLaren, Chris Amon, ended up leaving our country and heading overseas, didn't they?
Indeed. Well, here's my hope. I'm hoping that Robert Kennedy delivers in America and he exposes these big ag companies and big pharma, because he literally wrote the book on it for pharma with the Fauci book. And that's going to wake the world up. That's what I'm hoping for. I never thought we'd be at this optimistic place, because the forces of government and the forces of these big companies have been so overwhelming that people like you have just been washed away. They don't even care, because they can just beat you with the media, beat you in the courts, beat you with public opinion and burn your house down. But so I was thinking there's no point at where this can be exposed. But I feel with Robert Kennedy, maybe, just maybe, and Trump, maybe, just maybe. Well, I actually believe it will happen. I'll be bitterly disappointed if it doesn't. So hang in there.
Yeah, you chip away. And, you know, one of the Vietnam veterans that taught me a lot about this, you know, the ironic thing was it's World War II Vietnam veterans that helped us with this, not the Greens. The Greens
came along for the ride. The Greens just...
But, He just said, what we're doing here is correcting the historic record.
Yes.
And the use of strategic narratives in all these issues has been really powerful and readily brought by the public, wholesale. And that's.
I helped some Vietnam veterans through New Zealand with their, care as an MP. I was shocked at the number of birth defects they were having.
Yes. And one thing, Rodney, a bloke that I've had with, Ken Olsen, he's a professor in America. Him and his colleagues have published a whole series of paper on Agent Orange, and one of his latest papers on Agent Blue, and he talks about the 11,000 tons of arsenic that was dropped on Vietnam in Agent Blue for rice denial, and the 60-year media blackout on it. And it's an astonishing paper. You look at how they just blocked it out of the media, eh? It's quite incredible.
Incredible. The media are disgusting. Andrew, can you please keep in touch? I
Will do, Rodney.
thank you
Will
for your
do.
work. I have to say, pre-COVID, I would have been bamboozled by the media and read the headlines and thought, oh yeah, nothing to see here. Post-COVID, I know exactly what you're saying.
Yes, we've all learned a bit, haven't we? I
We
think.
have all learnt. We've all caught you up, as it were.
Much appreciated, Rodney.
Thank you for your time. What a great guy. That's,
Thank you.
oh, what a world we live in, that this has been going on for all this time. That was Andrew Gibbs, amazing researcher, doing this for decades, actually, looking into it and sharing with us. And it's tough for us to get on top of it and to understand it, like even a smidgen of what he does. But then you have to accept the enormity of the risk that we're exposed to, the damage that's been done, but how our government, our courts, our media, our government departments have not just let us down, but have covered it up. That's a staggering bit. Send us a text, 2057, email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. What a world, and how blessed are we are to have people like Andrew Gibbs battling away.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.